Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Prestige, a podcast film by film lovers for film lovers of all stripes. Each week we pick a film, we talk about that film, we review that film, and we discuss some of the ideas and themes or theories it throws up in our minds. But as always, every podcast, we have some regular elements. So we always end with our recommendations, so further reading based on the movie this week. But we always start with what else we've been watching. Now, this has been a bit of a dry spell for Sam as he adjusts to new parenthood. But do you have anything to mention this week, Sam?
Not really, Jared. No, I did want to talk about something that I thought was going to be perfectly hideous because of its time slot, because it's on at sort of 7:30-ish on a Saturday, and things that time generally are. And it seems to be a replacement for, in people's minds, a replacement for other talent shows, singing talent shows of its ilk. But I was pleasantly surprised by it, actually. It's called All Together Now. It's on BBC One just after 7 on a Saturday night. You can tell what I do with my Saturday nights now. there was something quite... I've heard you talk about the Bake Off before, and it's not something that I'm particularly invested in. I like your analysis of it, that it was just lots of other reality TV shows about taking people down and being negative towards other people. And there was something very just nice and comradely about Bake Off in the way that it was just a celebration of what people could do. And it felt like this was, while there was a competitive element and there was still the opportunity for people to be booed off sort of thing, it felt like, I mean, people sing to an audience and they get people standing up and joining in, and there was something quite nice about it in the wake of sort of more antagonistic reality TV shows like The X Factor and The Voice and Fame Academy and things like that. It just felt like this was post-Bake Off sort of a new direction for reality TV. So I welcomed that.
Oh, fair enough. I'll have to see if we can add it to our Saturday nights, which are equally as exciting as yours, I'm sure.
Yes.
Now, this week, I've actually watched a film that Sam has been recommending to me, or talking about at least, since I think the show started. It's one that he's brought up quite a lot, and I've always said, I should watch that, and I never have. And so it's the 2013 film Now You See Me, which is a sort of heist movie in the vein of things like The Sting, but the hook this time being that our main antagonists, I suppose, if you want to call them that, or anti-heroes, are a group of magicians. So they're bringing their magician flair, and that explains how they are able to do all the sleight of hand and all sort of the clever thinky stuff around the heists and the evasions of the cops that they sort of portray. I haven't seen the sequel yet. I don't know if that will live up to the first one, but I certainly enjoyed the first one. It was a very fun film. I think that the twists that it portrays to you are obvious a mile off for anyone who's seen a bunch of these films, but that doesn't diminish the fact that it's enjoyable. You're seeing people doing fun things. You know, I'm a fan of Eisenberg. I'm a fan of Mark Ruffalo. I think he does great work. Woody Harrelson, I think, is good value in any film he's in. Dave Franco was actually a bit of a revelation for me. He plays one of the magicians. And whilst I've only really seen him in Neighbours before, or Bad Neighbours, and things like that, he was very good putting his fight scenes. I thought he did very, very well. And Isla Fisher, was as the token girl, shall we say, in the group, was also very good. So it wasn't revolutionary. It certainly doesn't touch the giants of the genre like The Sting, Ocean's 11. But for a Thursday night when I had an evening to myself, it was very enjoyable.
Good. It was... I would stay clear of the sequel if I were you, because that will tarnish those good sets of good feelings about the first. It was. I've heard them interviewed. I've heard Jesse Eisenberg interviewed, and he said that Dave Franco, in sort of the training they had to do magic tricks together. I mean, it's part of it is is effects, but part of it is genuine trickery.
Mm.
And he said that Dave Franco was brilliant. He was by far the best Sledgehammer magician out of all four of them.
Yeah, and it was a good fun sort of, not dumb. It wasn't a dumb film. I don't know. It was just a good fun adventure, and I certainly welcome that. In a day and age of where films can be a bit too grim, dark, a bit too serious, this felt light-hearted and it sort of bounced along. But yeah, the twists, shall we call them that, weren't overly hidden. But that's half the fun of these things.
Yeah.
So this week, guys, we are moving on from our Metzger month, shall we say, of January. And we are moving from a quintessential Mexican director to a quintessential American director. And that we are looking at the filmography of Spike Lee. So this week started with his very first film, his breakout hit, we can call it, from 1986, She's Gotta Have It.
The reason I'm consenting to this is because I wish to clear my name. Not that I care what people think, but enough is enough. And if in the end it helps some other people out, well then that's fine too. I consider myself normal, whatever that means.
She's Gotta Have It is the, as Rob said, 1986 breakout movie from Spike Lee. Well, it's Spike Lee joint, in his words. He calls all the films joints. Starring Tracy Camilla Jones as Nola Darling, it tells the story of Nola, a young Brooklynite, and her relationship with a variety of different people of different genders, including primarily her three male lovers. Jamie, played by Tommy Redmond Hicks, Greer, John Canada Terrell, and Mars, played by young Spike Lee himself. Nola's decision between the three of them is delineated in the course of the film, which told in a sort of talking heads style documentary fashion.
I really enjoyed this film. Really enjoyed it. From the very first opening monologue, I was hooked. And a lot of that is down to Tracy Kuna Jones as Nola. She had a vivaciousness to her character that I just bought into completely. I thought she carried the film in a way that I very much enjoyed. It is of that sort of 80s, 90s movie era, the kind of the birth of the indie movement that you sort of see later on in other films. We may touch on this as we go through. But I really enjoyed it. I really, really enjoyed it. I think that, and we will move into to spoilers real fast here, guys. So if you haven't seen it, go see it. There is a scene towards the end of the film in which it can turn a bit violent, shall we say? And that was the one scene for me that really didn't work. And Spike Lee has gone on record as saying that it's his big regret of the film and he shouldn't have done it. And that, to me, that was the only misstep in this film.
It seemed that was out of character as well.
Yes, and it made a lot of things sort of change a lot of things in the movie. But he has said that it was a mistake, and so I'll take him as a director on that front. But I really dug it. I liked the talking head style. I liked the feeling that it was some sort of documentary, whilst the obviously things being told narratively. And I just thought all the characters were great. You know, Jamie, Greer, and Mars are three of the archetypes. They're very stereotypical characters. But each actor portrays them brilliantly, and you get that real snapshot of them really early on. And you get almost perfectly cast. You get this vibe of what they're like and who they are very, very fast from them. So I was on board as for my first Spike Lee film ever. I'm coming out of it on top. What about you, sir?
I really enjoyed it as well. It was well, neither of us know have particularly great knowledge of Spike Lee going into it, and it was for me it was an eye opening introduction. It was I thought in places it was the direction was better than the acting.
Mm-hmm.
I thought in places you just saw you saw how, I suppose at the beginning of their careers, some of these actors were, and some of the pieces to camera felt a little bit stilted. But then And while I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, maybe that's a device. Maybe they meant that. So ignore that. Maybe that was part of the film.
You know, I see what you're saying. I mean, particularly when I was watching it, I felt Jamie's piece of the camera a bit stilted.
Mm.
And I went back and forth where you are as well, going, I wasn't sure whether it was a new actor learning his way or that character did seem to be portrayed as nice but dull.
Yes.
The whole point of James Hunter was that he was not the obvious choice, but he was the clear choice, but he didn't have any of the excitement or he didn't have the humour of Mars or even the sort of the body of Greer. So it felt like he was meant to be a little bit awkward. Because it was set up in sort of contrast to someone like Mars, who throughout all of his was the motor mouth sort of over the top. But as I say, maybe reading too much into it, and we should have to accept that some actors aren't very good in their early days.
Yeah, I thought it was really good as a piece of history as well, and it had lots of things to say about the emergence of black identity on screen, and as it was, I mean, from the very beginning, when it opens with the Zora Neale Hurston quotation, you think, okay, that's where this is going. There are pictures of poor black neighbourhoods, these photographs at the beginning, and there's one photograph right near the beginning of, I think, a child's swing, and there was something very haunting about a photo in black and white and the body and ropes, and I thought maybe there was a reference to lynching. I thought maybe I was stretching a bit there, but there was something very evocative about these and this documentation of African American history coming for this film about a young woman in Brooklyn.
Well, I think for me, one thing I think I've often tricked on the show about Sam and I being two white kids from England. So my experience of the black existence is limited, let alone the black New York experience. But I will say this, like, as someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s, this is the black life that I was never shown on the movies I saw. And, you know, there's a movie that isn't about slaves. It isn't a movie about gang culture. It isn't a movie about prison. It isn't a movie about all the negative stereotypes of the black culture that are portrayed to us on media. And it isn't about having a token black guy, which is very often, you mean, you think about all the films in the 80s, you know, the big films, there's often a token black guy, be it, you know, in Die Hard, where you've got the one black cop, or in Predator, when you've got the one black, there's always the one black person, whereas this, it doesn't have it. It was kind of a bizarre, not bizarre, but it's a very different experience. And I wonder if seeing this film in the 80s when it came out would have been a very eye-opening experience. And even to this day, I mean, I think myself quite worldly when it comes to film, but there's certainly a subculture of, especially in America, black filmmaking.
Mm.
There are films that exist made by the black community of America for the black community of America. And I think they don't tend to break out of that mould too often. And this one felt that obviously it did kind of break out of that mould, but it was kind of interesting to see all this from another side. So yeah, it was for me, I really, really sort of dug it. And once again, it felt to me, and this is going to be strange to say, it felt like a 90s movie.
How do you mean?
Well, it just felt like, I mean, and I'll come on to these a bit later when we talk about our recommendations, but there's the 90s movement of indie films, things like Linklater making Slacker.
I see, yeah.
Kevin, and that kind of birth of this independent film in America. And to think that this film precedes them by 8-9 years, when I won't bury the lead here, but one of my recommendations down the line will be Clerks at the end. But this feels a contemporary something like Clerks, but it's made 8 years before Clerks.
Yeah,
and it's interesting, and I'm sure there's going to be there will certainly be a view of the idea that a black independent filmmaker made these films, and it took until, you know, 10 years later when white kids were doing it that it kind of broke out. But it's very interesting, this film, and particularly with its, I'm getting to this more of the sort of meat of the film here, this portrayal of female sexuality and the normalisation of alternative lifestyles, shall we say. And that feels like a very 90s feel. It feels like a very, it doesn't feel 80s.
Mm.
And so for me, it felt very strange that this film, you know, it came out in 86. You know, that's the same year as things like Platoon came out in this year. Ferris Bueller came out this year. You know, The Fly came out this year. Top Gun, the same year as Top Gun. These feel like films from different decades.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. When you were saying that this is a different take on a black experience, you have, I suppose, in the past 2 or 3 years, you've got 12 Years a Slave and Moonlight and Get Out, and it feels like the black community, cinematic community in America is finally saying, okay, right, now we can put these experiences on screen. But you're right, like Spike Lee was doing it 30 years ago.
But once again, I mean, this is us getting into race theory that I don't think I'm certainly not qualified to talk about. But once again, Spike Lee feels like the token black director.
I suppose so, yeah.
You know, it's the idea that we allowed a certain, that the white sort of hegemony on culture allowed this one. You know, they could always point to Spike Lee and say, see, you know, Spike Lee's there making films. Mm. And it's been brilliant that in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, we've got this explosion of black filmmakers and you know, people of colour of all stripes making movies. But up until then, you've got, you know, they could always point to Spike Lee. But I couldn't tell you another long-term black director working at Spike Lee level over these years.
No.
And it's a shame, because I think, I mean, I'd say maybe he goes off the boil. We'll see in the following weeks. But for me, this is a brilliant film. This is one that I will think about longer than it certainly sort of other films have.
Mm. And you think, I mean, he's 60. I mean, comparable directors in their 60s, you think people like Ridley Scott, who've had big profile careers in the film industry. And yeah, he's the one director of colour who's had a comparable career.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there's a whole book around that, I imagine.
Hmm.
But talking about the film itself, we haven't really seen the three loves of Nolan Darling. How did you, any thoughts on the kind of the meat of the film?
I'm just distracted by Googling Ridley Scott, who is a full 20 years older than Spike Lee. The point stands. yes, so the character Nola, I think she was an interesting one. She was particularly interesting because at the end of the film, and the film is called She's Got to Have It, and at the end of the film, she does have something, but what she has is the decision not to have what the rest of society seems to be telling her she should have. Mm. And at the end, what she's got to have it, the phrase seems to be about, is she's got to have control of her own identity, her own sexuality, her own decision-making process, rather than she's got to have a man or she's got to have a relationship.
I think that's right. I agree. I think that having it is having that. It throws to mind that old thing of having it all. You know, that women shouldn't have it all or want to have it all, that sort of stuff, and they use it as a judgment on women. But here, she's got a successful career. She's got clearly a loving family, and she wants more than one man can offer.
Mm.
And I think that's the film. I think it's very interesting in that it doesn't offer any judgment on her lifestyle. I think that's maybe why the rape scene towards the end sat so awkwardly with me, because it felt like a judgment. It felt like the film was turning to me and was saying, "Well, you know, if you live this lifestyle, this is what happens to you."
I see. Yeah,
and it felt like, you know, it's the idea that the woman who's sexual but unavailable is a tease.
Mm.
And it felt like the film was trying to say to me, you know, that this, she has teased Jamie too far, and she's pushed him too far. You know, Jamie is never presented as the bad guy in the movie, which, if you take the version of this film with that scene in it, he's certainly the bad guy.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, obviously you can kind of cut that scene out, and the film kind of still works. So taking his, Spike Lee's intention to remove that scene, the film doesn't offer judgment on her lifestyle, and neither does her family or her friends or even her psychiatrist she goes to see about it. So I think it'll be interesting that, particularly in the 80s, it doesn't offer any kind of judgment on this lifestyle. For me, thinking about things like Basic Instinct, and that whole sort of erotic thriller genre at the same time. You know, that's all about women's sexuality being a dangerous, violent thing that will kill you.
Hmm. Yeah, she's... Also, one of the reasons this was so interesting for me was that it was... I mean, this is a film that's made 30 years ago now. This is a film about a woman being in control of men. And you think of other films that were popular at the same time. I know something like Alien was significantly earlier, but that stands out to me as something from the 70s and 80s with a strong female lead. But it's a strong female lead where the adversary is not a man, it's an alien. This seemed to me to stand out as a film in which a strong female lead had male adversaries with whom she was going toe-to-toe and coming out on top.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's also interesting that none of the men, I mean, the men feel more confused by the situation than put out. Like the film kind of accepts, and they kind of accept that this is her life. And, you know, apart from, say, obviously, Jamie's reaction and Greer turning a little nasty when they break up, but it's still, once again, it's the men who come across as the unreasonable ones. And you know, as I say, once again, I haven't seen enough of black filmmaking of the year to know if this thing is unusual, but it certainly felt like, you know, to see a film like this that doesn't judge, you know, that kind of sexuality, it was very interesting.
Yeah. Some of the other things about this film that I wanted to talk about is the way in which it deals with the question of the choices that she makes, the allegiances that she makes, because this is about her choice between these three characters. And as we've sort of been dancing around, this is a story of three archetypes. So this is a decision between an aesthetic ideal seen in Greer and another, a choice between him and the sort of knockabout humour of I keep calling him Spike, not Spike, Miles, and the I suppose the homeliness, if a bit boring, until that scene towards the end of Jamie. And this seems to me a decision for her between these three characters, and I wonder whether this was something that Spike Lee was exploring about the decisions of the 1980s, or whether this is more general. I suppose that's sort of partly answered because he's chosen to go back to this. I mean, there's a 2018 TV series of She's Got Out of It. So this is something that he feels he needs to revisit. This idea of choice is something he feels that he can go back to.
No, I haven't seen any of the new show, but it's interesting because the film feels such a closed unit. It does. I'm very intrigued. I mean, it's a Netflix show, and Netflix are good at kind of finding a show from a movie. Something like Westworld is a good example of that. But I'm very intrigued to know what they've done with it. I don't know if it's a prequel, if it's telling the same story. It feels like the film's like a closed little kind of bubble, and it works that way. And I'm very, not reticent, but I'm very intrigued to know how they're going to try and spin that out into a TV show.
Yeah, I saw the trailer, and it just seemed to me, my attention was wandering because someone was screaming in my ear, but it seemed to me that what it was doing was just following the story of the film, and I thought, well, that's is missed a trick there, because like you say, it would have been more interesting to explore other avenues. It does seem very close, the film.
I have no interest in knowing how Nola became Nola. I have no interest in knowing why she to somehow explain her polyamory. I'm happy for her just to be. If you see what I'm saying, I don't need a deep dive into understanding why she's the way she is, because I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I worry that trying to stretch this out into too much of a show would end up having to dive into kind of the psychology of it all, shall we say.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's something the film does really well, that this could sort of very quickly turn into a psychological exploration of why she gets like that. But the excerpt with the psychoanalyst is very quickly cut off, because she says, mm-hmm. I don't need this. This is Greer putting ideas in my head. I genuinely don't need, there's nothing wrong with me. And you get the feeling that the psychoanalyst kind of agrees with that as well.
I think that it's the film's power that it kind of takes that line.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, Sam, do you have some recommendations for us from this week's film?
I do. I don't know how you did with the actors involved, but there wasn't a lot going on with them for me. I did find, actually, this was just an excuse to talk about this film, really. That psychoanalyst, Epatha Murkison, Dr. Jameson, was also in Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which is not an amazing film, but it's just, I mean, at the beginning of the podcast, you talked about fun Thursday evening films. I think this is a fun Thursday evening film. It's worth watching, if only to see Robert Patrick melt through a door. I mean, it's just, it's fun.
Oddly enough, growing up, I saw T2 before I saw T1. And so a lot of that film, the power of T2 was lost to me, because I'm like, I didn't know that Arnie was supposed to be a bad guy.
No.
So I just started watching it, like, oh yeah, it's a fun film. And then I watched the first one, I'm like, it makes so much more sense.
Yes. Second one is a bit of a cheat, actually. It's a film that I haven't actually seen, so it's a recommendation for me as much as for anyone else. You've talked about the film staying with you, and I agree with that. Actually, one of the things that has stayed with me as much as the narrative is the music. I love the music of this film. And one of the principal musicians, in fact, the guy playing trumpet and flugelhorn, which is the principal melody at the beginning and throughout, is Virgil Jones. And he was amazingly evocative. And he was also on the soundtrack of Straight Out of Brooklyn, which was a 1991 film, which I'm interested to see, given that he was working on it. It may be utterly terrible, but you never know. So a recommendation for me as well.
Fair enough. I did actually find an actor link. We had to say it hasn't gone to a lot. I think I'm finding that during this director's sort of year, that a lot of the early films, the crew are, the cast are sort of, for various reasons, unknowns who don't often go anywhere. So I've taken one I mentioned earlier and then Young mentioned. So the first one is Clerks from 1994. Mm. I just felt these films were in the same box, the same kind of style, the same kind of indie vibe, the same kind of sort of feeling to the film. And they felt very similar in ways I can't really express in words. But they felt like two parts of a larger sort of narrative about the untold lives of people. And Clerks and Kevin Smith is one of the reasons why I end up making films. So I always find a chance to plug that if I can. The other one actually works on that same level, but also has an actor link. And that is Joy Lee, who played one of the parts, Spike Lee's sister. And she pops up in the 2003 film Coffee and Cigarettes by Jim Jarmusch, which essentially is a series of vignettes, series of short stories strung together, all in black and white, some funny, some heartfelt. It has well-known actors like Steve Buscemi, Bill Murray, but also Iggy Pop, Tom Waits, the White Stripes. All kind of people, all acting, all telling little stories, all telling little scenes, all over Coffee and Cigarettes. It's very indie. It's very kind of that kind of filmmaking. But I think it's easy to see a through line over, in over 20 years from She's Gotta Have It, Clerks, and Coffee and Cigarettes in this kind of low-key, black-and-white, story-based filmmaking. So yeah, if you haven't, Clerks, everyone probably have seen. Coffee and Cigarettes hasn't got quite as wide a viewing audience. But if you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth quite some time to go see.
Brilliant. Next week we're moving on in Spike Lee's oeuvre with Do the Right Thing. is probably his most famous film.
Mm-hmm.
So find that out if you search that out if you haven't seen before, and give it a watch before next week.
Till then, guys, you can find me on Twitter at Rob Kaiju.
You can find me at life_academic.
And you can find both of us at Pretty Podcast. And just a quick thank you to Twitter user Sean_Batten and his friend who have been helping us troubleshoot some of the audio issues we've been having on the show. So if the audio sounds better this week and last week, please send all thanks to Sean Batten. He is he's been helping us a lot. So cheers, Sean, and hope this one's better for you.
Prestige is a Kaiju Industries production. Check out their other work at facebook.com/Kaiju Industries. Rawr! Arr.